Welcome to the Newsbusters podcast with your host, executive editor of Newsbusters, Tim Graham.
Hello and welcome. Well, it's all over now. The Ronna McDaniel debacle is over. She lasted less than Scaramucci at the White House podium, and people are making fun of that, but they apparently signed her on Friday and dumped her several days later, much to the delight of Morning Joe and Nicole Wallace and her sacred airwaves and Rachel Maddow. It was really unbelievable. So in my latest nationally syndicated column, I really went into, in particular, Rachel Maddow going to town, comparing Ronna McDaniel to a mobster and a pickpocket. You wouldn't hire a mobster to work at a DA's office, right? You wouldn't hire a pickpocket to work as a TSA screener. It's just like, do they understand how out of control they sound? I mean, Ronna McDaniel can say, not a particularly great chairman of the RNC if you look at the election results. On the other hand, she was the RNC chair under Trump. And, you know, when everybody Trump wants wins the Senate primaries in 22 and then they all go blazing down to defeat, do we blame Ronna McDaniel or the big guy? All I know is what this looks like is they all want to say, see, we stood up to the Trumpers. You know, that's where they get very righteous. Where Maddow talks about Ronna McDaniel's for the end of democracy, all this kind of garbage. But in reality, MSNBC viewers do not want to see Republicans, not the real ones. They'll take Michael Steele. That was one of the comedy lines in all this, where Joy Reid's like, I'm not against having Republicans in MSNBC. I let Michael Steele host my show. Come on. Yes, that was really, if you wanted to say something negative about Ronna McDaniel, they would say, well, how long does it take till Ronna gets to Michael Steele? Well, they hired her to analyze 2024. I hope it wouldn't be within a month or two. But this is the problem, is that at NBC and at MSNBC, we remember what happened to Megyn Kelly. They could not stand having Megyn Kelly work there. She had to be spit out like a rotten grape. And so, you know, I guess the liberals win. And on some level, I think maybe MSNBC thinks this whole period of outrage makes them look great to their listeners. But to the rest of America, it just underlines MSNBC is not a news channel. It's there to fearmonger about Trump and to, you know, to be the wind beneath Biden's wings most of the time. Okay, we got a new study joining us now. Our PBS specialist, our public broadcasting analyst, Mr. Clay Waters. Clay has been with the Media Research Center in one form or another since 1993. Young intern with a rope belt from Mississippi, now coming to us from Florida. But he had this idea. Let's do a study of this show, Washington Week. Well, Washington Week sort of got colonized by the Atlantic magazine last August. So now they call it Washington Week with the Atlantic. So Clay has taken a look at 6 months of episodes. We just released the study, but it's from August, mid-August to mid-February of this year. And shockingly, we found it had a rather dramatic liberal bias. Right, Clay?
Right. Yeah. I figured with the Atlantic colonization, it'd be a good time to check in, see how our taxpayer-supported political roundtable is doing. And we found some pretty striking negative bias against Republicans and some oddly biased by omission, we call it, against Democrats. A lot of Democratic things were simply ignored.
So, yes, let's look at the key findings. More than half of the topics that they addressed focused on the Republicans. 88 of the topics compared to 38 that focused on the Democrats. I think this is unsurprising in a sense, in that liberal reporters think the scandalous happenings or the objectionable things they need to talk about are Trump and the congressional Republicans. But yes, this is where we go back to saying who's president?
Right. It sounds like on face value, that sounds okay. That's fair enough. Republicans are getting coverage for what they're doing. But we have to remember that Washington Week is not a typical news broadcast. They're talking about topical controversies, controversies that are in the news, scandals, who's up, who's down politically. So they're not, it's not a campaign favor to the GOP when they're doing that. In fact, the Democrats are probably helped when their scandals are omitted.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, this is kind of what we do. And this is, I suppose we should have started with this, Clay. Washington Week actually has been on the air since 1967, on PBS since 1970. And it was called Washington Week in Review for many years. And then they shortened it for some reason. Then they dropped the in review. But the same principle of the program or operating procedure of the program is the same, which is a moderator and generally four journalists. And they sit around and quote unquote empty their notebooks about what they reported on this week. And so it's a very, it's meant to be a civil conversation about public affairs. But as it's a PBS show, so it's a big liberal bubble. So you said not only did the panelists spent 149 minutes opining about Republicans, nearly 90% of it in negative fashion. The Democrats received just 66 minutes of opinionated commentary, split much more evenly, 57% negative to 43% positive.
Yeah, we were talking about just now about the 80s. It was for me, PBS. I watched PBS because it was polite, sedate, and also relatively balanced. I watched the McLaughlin Group. They had it. They had the chairs going left for Eleanor Cliff and right to usually Pat Buchanan or Fred Barnes, and it was entertaining. But this iteration of Washington Week is incredibly slanted toward a mainstream conventional wisdom left. They have reporters from the New York Times, Politico, the Washington Post, left-leaning outlets. You're not going to find these days anyone from a conservative-leaning outlet. We don't have a Fox News person as a guest on the roundtable, a Wall Street Journal editorial page person, no, and no Washington Examiner.
Right.
So they have liberal reporters spouting liberal opinions, and the other liberals that were at the table agreeing is basically what I found.
Yeah, and you make a good point. I mean, when I first came to Washington in the late 80s, I always watched the McLaughlin Group. Now, here in Washington at the time, it aired on Channel 4, the NBC station, but across the country, it was a PBS program. And the funny thing about programs like this is I don't know if the McLaughlin Group was aired at a reasonable time. I don't know where it aired in Mississippi. We got it, I think, Saturday at like 6:30 p.m., do you remember?
I think we got it Friday, either at 7 or 8. I remember one day, this is how what a nerd I became. Lonnie Guinier was in trouble. She was, I think, a Clinton appointee. And I was trying to guess what the McLaughlin would say about it. And I guessed, so long, Lonnie. And I was right.
Yes, John
Things
McLaughlin.
You remember.
Yes, John McLaughlin hosted the program. And he always, that was his big thing that he really wanted to make predictions about what was going to happen. That was part of what made the show entertaining, I guess, was them all trying to guess the way it was going to come down. But yes, that program, as you suggested, had conservatives and liberals and centrists, you know, Morton Kondracki in the middle. Washington Week is nothing of the sort. And the thing that was funny to me was, yes, if somebody like Major Garrett, when he was at Fox News, did not show up on Washington Week. He did not show up on the Journalist Roundtable on the Diane Rehm Show on Friday mornings. And I remember when he joined CBS and he showed up back at NPR and Diane Rehm was like, well, welcome back. Now that you're at a real news station, you know. And that's exactly the principle here that's going on with Washington Week is it's like, oh, we don't allow anybody from Fox News here. And so, yes, I mean, Chris Wallace could now go on now, but he couldn't go on when he was at Fox. I mean, that's just, that is the way it is. And maybe it's because, you know, the PBS audience really doesn't like this sort of thing. I just don't know how much PBS viewers were upset by McLaughlin back in the day, but it was,
yeah, there's not this instant reflexive way. There was no Twitter to it for these. It's a thumbs up or thumbs down. And even like John McLaughlin, moderator trying to extract opinions from everybody. And today's Washington Week is Jeffrey Goldberg, who's himself a fairly liberal Democrat. So you're not going to get any attempt at balance there. So there's really no room for a Republican or conservative voice.
Yeah, I mean, we should underline that now that you brought it up, and that is that the Atlantic magazine under Jeffrey Goldberg is a Democrat rag. The Atlantic, which never endorsed presidential candidates before Jeffrey Goldberg, now has endorsed Hillary Clinton in 2016, Joe Biden in 2020, and surely to come, Joe Biden in 2024. They've run some really provocative articles on COVID. We'll all remember the Georgia's experiment in human sacrifice. That was about Governor Kemp trying to prevent a super lockdown. And so, yes, to me,
they did this, the magazine that ran a January 2024 issue, an entire issue warning about the dangers of an authoritarian second Trump administration. And they had the issue of the Atlantic magazine, and they made it into a full Washington Week in Review episode.
Correct.
Devoted all 23 minutes to it.
Well,
so, yes.
This was the interesting thing. We should underline this. This really is Washington Week with the Atlantic, because as you found, you said in this particular episode, every panelist on the show was from the Atlantic. But when you try to count up appearances, the number one media outlet for appearances is the Atlantic. I think it's also important, Clay. I want to run some sound. They were probably the most definitive soundbite of this period with Jeffrey Goldberg was when they were discussing just how mentally acute Joe Biden is. Let's listen to that.
Donald Trump, they're running ads showing Biden tripping every 5 seconds, and I think that you know, creates an aura that sticks, that is sort of stuck with Joe Biden. John Trump has always been very good at branding his opponents, in ways that they can't shake. And this seems to be one of those examples, is to talk about Biden's age and his health. And every time he coughs, we're going to put that in an ad. And they don't do, there's no counterpart to that aimed at Donald Trump, who is, has a different demeanor than Biden, but certainly has things you could point out about his own age. And
could I just point out, though, that, I mean, it's not just making an issue of Biden's age. It's lying. It's saying he's senile. It's saying he's demented. Saying he's out of it. I mean, I think it's important to sort of state for a fact that a lot of these are just smears.
Right. Mentally, he's quite acute.
Seems right. Like it.
Yeah.
I think this underlines just how much Jeffrey Goldberg is in the pocket of the Democrats. Jeffrey Goldberg called Barack Obama the greatest terrorist hunter president we've ever had. You know, I mean, it's the gush that comes forth. Now, obviously, Clay, I think terrorism.
And the Biden thing, I mean, that comment, I think it was Leibovich and Mark Leibovich, that aged about as well as Biden has aged. It, especially, this was after the Biden's press conference.
Yes.
After the Robert Hur report.
Okay.
The special counsel, yep.
Yes. I don't think they didn't try that so much after the State of the Union. I'm sure they still gave him high marks. I'm going to yell at people for 70 minutes and then they'll say I'm lucid. So other findings, Republicans were branded as extreme 11 times over the 6 month period. Democrats, zero. Well, what a surprise.
That did. Yeah, that I almost thought they called Biden an extremist, but I listened to it very closely and they said Biden in extremis, the Latin.
Ah.
So, yeah. Can't always go by the transcript.
Which could be, any number of things. I mean, it could be in extremis in style or rhetoric or something.
I think he was, they say, Biden in trouble with polls. Now, let me clarify. It was not their coverage. It's leans towards controversy. So it wasn't 100% Biden worship. But even when they were criticizing Biden, it was a lot about, oh, he's not doing so well in the polls these days. He's not appealing to the left these days.
Right. This is where when you say it's 57% negative, well, we have to do that, put an asterisk on it, because some of the negative is he's not left-wing enough.
And you might need an asterisk on the Republican side, even though it's 90% negative to 10% positive. Some of that is, Nikki Haley's doing well. I tried to stay consistent with how I was calling people, positive coverage, negative coverage.
Yep.
And so Mitt Romney, Utah retired senator, a lot of his positive coverage was, oh, he's a brave moderate sticking up for the history of the Republican Party against these new Trumpian authoritarians. Now, I mean, whatever you think of Romney or Haley, that they were positioned as against Donald Trump, who, you know, like it or not, is going to probably be the Republican nominee.
Right. So you found in all of the evaluations, Trump got 92.6% negative. And by comparison, Nikki Haley, 23.8% negative. And of course, many, many, many more minutes, you know, yeah. 72 to about six.
The Republicans in Congress, say what you will about dysfunctional Congress, but 99% negative, I think that would be seen as a little extreme.
Yeah.
And well, there was one positive segment, and it was Jeffrey Goldberg, this was during the anti-Semitism hearings, and Jeffrey Goldberg did admit that, oh, you know, they kind of make a good point about DEI on campus, diversity, equity, inclusion, and that was it for positive coverage of Republicans in Congress.
Yeah, and Mike Johnson, 96% negative. And we go over to, so the Republicans get 99% negative. The Democrats get 17.8% negative. But once again, you have 46 minutes on the Republicans and about four on the Democrats.
Yes, exactly. Not only is it negative coverage on Democrats is not going to mean as much because they were so much less covered in general. They had very little interest in Democratic scandals. Hunter Biden, maybe a minute and a half. Senator Menendez, the gold bars. They had 34, not even a minute, 34 total seconds.
So, yes, you said Menendez is...
They did not, they skipped.
Menendez was 100% negative in those 34 seconds. And but this was funny. Hunter Biden, 104 seconds, 75 seconds positive, 29 negative, 27.9 negative as a percentage.
That's pretty impressive. Yes. One of the panelists was kind of doing this emotional rant about, you know, he's suffered so much. He struggled so much. He's trying to get his life back together. So yeah, we had to go with, you know, that's positive with Hunter. Let me just a couple of Democrats, mostly squad members that they totally ignored. Rep Jamal Bowman, who pulled the fire alarm in the House to stop a vote. Zero. Rep Cori Bush of Missouri, alleged campaign finance violations, security payments to her boyfriend, zero. And Rep Rashida Tlaib, the anti-Semitic comments she made after October 7th, zero.
Yeah, I mean,
meanwhile, Republican embarrassments were covered.
You would think that they could have, Jeffrey Goldberg could have a minute to say, and the House passed a resolution against Hamas raping Israeli women. Tlaib abstained. It's like, this is what's so comical. Now, I'm going to slip over for 2 seconds to what you've been doing on the New York Times. And that is same kind of thing, is that we've got our old friend Carl Hulse, Capitol Hill hack at the New York Times. And he'll do these stories where there's like 8 uses of far right and a couple of ultra conservatives. And it's like, where on earth is the far left in Congress? Carl Hulse can never find it.
He went into his lab and cooked up a new one. Ultra right. I like that.
Yeah.
Ultra conservative, far right.
Ultra right.
Yes.
Yes.
He is notorious. He is one of my favorites, actually, because he is so reliable about the labeling, the hostile anti-Republican labeling.
And of course, this makes him a good panelist on Washington Week.
Yes. He, as far as I can tell, he's fairly sedate compared to his copy. Someone who's not sedate was PBS. Every once in a while, they'll have a guest moderator, Laura Barron Lopez, and she was incredibly biased and hostile to Ron DeSantis, I believe, on her first visit to the panel.
Well, and again, so most of the time, Clay is looking at, we start with the PBS NewsHour when we evaluate PBS. That's the flagship news program. And there are other things we watch. We obviously watch Washington Week on Friday nights. We do check out Amanpour and Company, which starts at CNN. And this was what happened when Charlie Rose said bye-bye. They run Christiane Amanpour reruns, so to speak, on PBS. But we do also analyze that. And Frontline, their documentary program is another one of those things that that we'll have a tendency to try to look at, except it's kind of hard because they do these two-hour-long documentaries, and you're like, what am I going to pluck out of that for 500 words?
There was a three-hour documentary, Texas Gay Rights, over three nights, and that was a challenge. I think we pulled some stuff out of there. You know, someone has to watch all that. It's us.
Well, Brent Baker alerted us to the fact that they're apparently doing, what, an American Experience or American Masters? I forget which show. They're doing a William F. Buckley show.
William F. Buckley. I wish I could remember the reading, but the trailer looked fairly respectful until the very end. What do they call him? They called him Blabbermouth or something. They crossed out one word in the trailer and put an insult. And I will be eager to see how that one compared to the Moynihan, the Daniel Patrick Moynihan episode they did just a few days ago.
We should always note for people who may not understand this that L. Brent Bozell III, who is the founder and president of the MRC, is, of course, the nephew of William F. Buckley. He would just refer to him as Tio, which is Spanish for uncle. We'll be watching that with special interest. I guess one of the things, Clay, we could argue that we haven't done a lot of blogs on is this program titled Firing Line with Margaret Hoover, which is nothing like Firing Line with William F. Buckley. But I think they think because Margaret Hoover is the granddaughter of Herbert Hoover. She's also the wife of CNN analyst / congressional candidate John Avalon. But I guess we haven't found her being outrageously liberal, but she's certainly not somebody you would expect to be a Buckley conservative.
Yeah, it seems what I've seen of it is fairly conventional wisdom. And I was trying to think of the other Bonnie.
Oh, Bonnie Urbay. To the contrary. Yeah, that's one of those shows, though, where you go, is that still on?
Yes.
Because now, To the Contrary was sort of like Washington Week for women. I mean, because everybody on it was a female journalist or political analyst. And there was, at one point, we did a lot of stuff on that because Bonnie Urbay, who I think had come over from Mutual Radio, but she would say some outrageously Democrat feminist stuff. And
I know one of their favorite guests of theirs, Eleanor Holmes Norton, the D.C., former D.C. Representative.
Oh, she's still there. Isn't she still there as the not quite congresswoman? I forget.
I had forgotten.
The most infamous episode of To the Contrary was Julianne Malveaux, right? The leftist who said, I hope Clarence Thomas's wife feeds him lots of eggs and butter so he dies early of heart disease.
Now, Tim, that was just high irony. Don't you know this? I believe that was her response.
It was one of the most raucous audience responses we ever got at an MRC event where Clarence Thomas dropped in and said, and this was not 20 years ago, something. I forget which year, but he came in and he said, my cardiologist says my heart rate is excellent,
Our people understood the reference.
Yeah. I think they probably played the clip before he got up there so that everybody totally got the reference.
Yeah, that'd be good.
But PBS was one of the original networks. Obviously, it started with NPR and Nina Totenberg, but PBS went live that whole weekend of the Hill Thomas hearings and put Nina Totenberg on with Paul Duke to try to destroy the Thomas nomination. So,
and we also follow National Public Radio when we can.
Yes, and I try to get around to that. As people on this podcast, the regulars on this podcast know, I do quite often discuss National Public Radio, because I listen to it in my car and get angry with it. So it is what we do. So we all know what we're getting, I guess, with Washington Week with The Atlantic. I think it might be interesting Will they have, I guess this is our question, Clay, will they have a panel where they bring on all the Atlantic journalists when they do the "We Endorse Biden" issue? And now
that would be a lot of, that would be nervy. That would take some gall.
And now you tell us how excellent and mentally acute he is. What do you think? You know, but yes, I mean, this whole idea of PBS, we're fair and balanced, and that's why we have a whole program on how Trump's second term will be the end of democracy.
I guess the, at some level, this partisan times, I was doing some research. I was trying to find the very first PBS McNeil Lehrer NewsHour. That's what the PBS NewsHour used to be called.
Yes.
And I swear to goodness, I think it was a 60-minute analysis of fighting in Chad, Africa. I mean, that is a, for us, that is a classic PBS topic. Slightly dull, very worthy, relatively politically. No connection to U.S. politics. Things have certainly changed.
Well, let me close with this. Let me close with this, Clay. Assigned reading. Maybe you did read this, but my old friend Larry Jarvik, who gave us a lot of advice on the PBS system, wrote a book called PBS Behind the Screen. And if anybody's nerdy enough to want to look back at the history, the book now is, I don't know, 15, 20 years old, but very good book. But I believe McNeil Lehrer started in like 75 or 6, and it was a half an hour. It was the McNeil Lehrer Report, I think is how it started. And then somewhere in there, I think in the 80s, they said, oh, let's go an hour. But yes, PBS is known as being daring to do extremely boring foreign affairs reporting. I mean, frankly, that's a good thing. It's the best thing you could say about NPR is, which American news outlet's going to do the most reporting from Africa? NPR, without a doubt. But then the question is, do you trust the reporting they're doing from Africa? But at least they're non-commercial. They don't have to sit there and listen to some accountant say, nobody cares about Africa. They really care about Princess Kate has cancer. 2 hours on that, please.
Yeah, and I remember in 1993 was an intern at MRC. A lot of NewsHour coverage of Bosnia,
yes,
and the whole Yugoslavia, those things, and it was old news because y'all were catching up. So I can't say I paid attention, but I'm glad it was out there.
Yeah, I mean this, and that's where you'd say the best argument still for public broadcasting, and it doesn't really have much of a rationale in today's society. It just doesn't, because so often now PBS and MSNBC, you can't really tell the difference. But the best rationale you would have is it's willing to take on boring topics nobody else wants to do. But you
think that's their new fundraising slogan.
We're boring. Watch us. We're boring. Do you want to know what's going on in Chad? The civil war in Sudan. Yes. On NPR, Clay, I listen to the BBC NewsHour comes on at 9 a.m. and that's what they'll do. And now 20 minutes on Sudan. Okay. All right. So we are quite agitated about public broadcasting. We've been agitated about it since this place was started in 1987. We've got it all on tape, but we're still watching it minute by minute, hour by hour. Here in 2024, and when you want to see what's going on at PBS or NPR, you know, you come to Newsbusters once, twice, 24 times a day. Thanks for listening.